It's time to check out IdeaJam, the Web 2.0 idea management application for Lotus Notes and Domino that runs on Domino 6, 5, 7, and 8, is available as a simple and easy-to-install application. For more information, head over to elguji.com. That's ELGUJI.com. Get your idea on with the software that may just earn you that well-deserved vacation. Let them know you learned about IdeaJam on the Taking Notes podcast. It's time for the Taking Notes podcast with Julian Robichaud and Bruce Elgort.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 86 of the Taking Notes podcast for Wednesday, August 13th, 2008. My name is Bruce Elgort, and I am here with
Julian Robichaud.
And we have the two guys from the Yellowcast podcast, Tim Tricconi and Chris Tuohy. Gentlemen.
Yo.
Hello.
So this is kind of interesting because I think in the background we're probably going to have like dueling banjos playing, right, Tim?
Yeah, I think that'd be appropriate.
Yeah, I think it was your suggestion.
How do you know we don't already have it playing, Bruce?
Well, don't mess with my mind. Why are we here, Julian?
We are here because we want to talk about developing applications, probably specifically notes applications, but we can go generic, and whether or not, I guess what the advantages and disadvantages are for creating a product and spending all this time creating some kind of application or code or whatever, and either offering it free to the world or trying to charge for it. And really, it just so happens that Chris and Tim, you guys were talking about something recently, I think, on one of your Yellowcast podcasts, and I know that both of you guys have recently put some applications out for sale. Is that right?
Yeah, I have a few weeks back.
Okay. And Chris, don't you have a few templates that you're offering up to the world?
Yeah, I put them out. I couldn't get people to download the things for free, let alone sell them. So...
No, that's one reason why you should sell them. Perceived value, right?
Right. Yep.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. So really, on the one hand, we're going to be talking about that. It just so happens that Chris and Tim happen to have another Lotus Notes podcast, and so it's very convenient that we also have some other vocal talent in these two guys. But let's just start talking about this. And Bruce, actually, I want to start with you because you're sort of the old man of the group,
oh,
right?
Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. So I was just kind of checking, dates and looking at some of the things that we've all done in the past. And Bruce, I think you were really first up to bat with both the Lookout Express template as well as the, kind of the whole OpenNTF or Notes OSS concept. So tell us about your history with producing applications for free.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were going to pick on me first. Well, I spent a good portion of my Lotus career writing software and actually pimping software, right? That was developed by others that was free. And you are correct. I think the first thing that may have gotten into people's hands, and Julian, I mean, and guys, let's go back. There's been the Lotus Sandbox has been around forever. People have put stuff in there, but I think those were mostly Lodi putting that stuff in there, right? Is that?
The Sandbox used to be a pretty mixed bag. And then several years ago, it really kind of got shut down to where the stuff that got put in there was really only like Lotusphere and DeveloperWorks related, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, getting back to things, I'm thinking here. Lookout Express was something that Ed Brill back in, I guess, 2001? Boy, I'm dating myself. I think it was the winter or the December of 2001 when Ed and I were chatting, and yeah, just shows how long I've known Ed. We were talking, chatting on AOL IM, and somehow we got talking about how Notes, you know, was getting beat up in the market again, and by the fact that it couldn't compete with Outlook, that the Outlook UI was killing, you know, note sales and stuff like that. So I guess Nathan and I, because I think Nathan and I actually did some work on it, we put together an Outlook-like face for the Lotus Notes mail template. And, I don't know how many people actually downloaded that, because I think, I don't even know if OpenNTF was really a site to download stuff at that point. But it was pretty interesting, you know. A lot of people asked for it, but I don't know. I mean, yeah, Lookout Express, yeah, for sure. That was one of the first apps that we got out there for free. Now after that, and that's when the landslide kind of occurred, when about 12 of us from around the globe decided to add some value to the mail template. Which way back in the day, I think it was maybe 2002, and don't shoot me if I have the date wrong, but that's when the Notes mail template really didn't have many features that we come to rely on today, such as reply and forward indicators and follow-up flags and stuff like that. So those things were added to the Notes mail template, and that thing was like, you know, if I had a dollar for every person who downloaded it, I think once we started keeping track, you know, it's probably in the 20,000s at least at this point. And I know major companies that are actually using it. So
now, Bruce, was that while you were still Notes Sauce, or were you officially Notes or OpenNTF at that time? When was that transition?
That was the transition was probably 6 or 7 months after Notes OSS came to be. I think it was in the May or June timeframe of 2002 when we actually changed the name. So the OpenNTF mail template, I think, came out with the release of Notes 6, I think. So again, I should have written all these dates down, but it was a long time ago if you think about it, even if it was 2002, what, 6 years ago? So it's been around a long time. And
there's still at least a few people using the original certifier, or at least IDs created from the original certifier.
Because
once in a while, I get an ECL pop-up for Notes OSS.
God, I hate when that happens.
I actually still have a Notes OSS t-shirt. Bruce, I think you gave me like your very last one.
That's the one I wore, Julian, for a year and didn't wash it, but...
That's right,
I wanted it to be special. But, you know, since the mail template came along, I mean, what, there's 150 or 200 free applications out on OpenNTF now. So,
right. And then I guess recently you've kind of jumped ship from OpenNTF or jumped ship from the free world and started actually offering a commercial product, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's something I think we should jump into later, because I think there's a lot of people out there, including yourself, who have written free stuff, but I know from experience and from emails sitting in my email box that there are companies willing to pay, you know, for code. They're willing to pay support. They're willing to pay top dollar, you know, for well-documented, well-done application. So I encourage anyone out there who has an idea in their head that they should write the code and package it up and sell it. So, you know.
Oh, interesting. Well, and as a matter of fact, that's what Chris Toohey himself has done, right, Chris?
Yeah, but my biggest problem is that I suck at sales. I suck at telling people within a short blurb what my products can do. Now, Tim on our podcast was talking about SOTU and Xcopy, and he put it so perfectly that I was like, you know, I wish I had that talent of being able to say, well, this is exactly what it does. If you read the how-to or about this database and it says you can do this and this and this and this, it's really so far off of what it can do. I'm just not gifted with that marketing tongue.
Well, in your defense, though, you've heard me ramble on about the stuff I've written, and I think there's an interesting mindset, and I don't know how pertinent this is, but when we're the developer, as opposed to the user, even if originally we developed it because we were the user, which was, in my case, for JS Factory, that's what happened. I wrote it for myself as something to use, but every once in a while I would hear somebody say, you know, this is such a pain. Why do I have to do all this manually? And my response was, well, yeah, I've got something that does that. And it's, well, can I buy it? Okay. Not yet. But that transition from being the user to the developer, oddly enough, it seemed to shift my mindset to where it actually made it more difficult for me to explain what it actually does, at least in the 30-second soundbite, right? Mm-hmm. But when I download something that you've written, unless I've actually dug into the code and tried to modify it to where, again, I shift into that other role, I'm just the user. So I'm just describing what it allows me to do. So
do you think
it
it's
is difficult
to be
in that.
See the- You can't see the forest from the trees?
Yeah, because that often impacts our testing process too, right? We've had the blinders on for so long writing the code that when we want to test it thoroughly, to some extent we might actually be seeing what we expect to see. I think that also affects the marketing of it as well. When we're trying to explain to somebody why it's worth their money, I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, Tim, what about the – was it called Excited that you were working on just probably a couple years ago now? JavaScript to essentially JavaScript editor for notes databases online?
Wasn't it kind of like Notes Designer for the web?
That's exactly what it was, yeah. I first got the idea for it about 6 years ago now, but – at the time, I had no idea how I would even go about implementing it. And then about 2.5 years ago, the contract I was in at the time, within the same week, gave me three separate new reasons for wanting to have it. And by that point, I had noticed that nobody else had written anything like that. And the types of things I was working with, it was just a natural transition. So I started experimenting, and I actually got it to the point where you could successfully edit any non-visual element from the web. So script libraries, agents, web services, forms and views, you could do the action buttons and all the events like query save, post open, etc. All of that worked in the last version of Excited that I came up with. I just never got to the visual stuff of creating columns and adding fields to forms, things like that. But all of the non-visual elements worked. Even uploading of shared resources, so you could replace an existing image resource from a file upload dialog, etc. And it actually had a few things that Domino Designer doesn't, like integrated version control. And so I was, my original plan was I was going to sell that. But ironically, what interrupted that was when I got the position at Lotus 911. Partly because, I'll go ahead and confess right now, the main reason I wanted to sell Excited and not just give it away for free was I had this pipe dream that I would be able to sell it to enough people that would be my job. I would just support that one application. And then when I got the offer from Lotus 911, I set that aside for the time being because I thought, well, this is a dream opportunity. I want to focus on this. And in the 15 months that I've been with Lotus 911, I actually haven't touched Excited since, because my original reason for wanting to sell it has gone away. With what I've got right now, I don't want to be freelance. So, but ironically, the original reason for writing it had nothing to do with money. I wanted a tool to be able to edit design elements from the web.
Go ahead.
At some point, I got greedy, and so eventually it turned into. I got to get this working so I can sell it. And I kind of, to be perfectly honest, it took the fun out of it for me. Now, if it hadn't been all about the money, if it had been like with JS Factory, I put it on sale for $10 and 5 people bought it. And that's cool. So, you know, hopefully those folks are happy with it. But with that, it wasn't about the money. It was just, well, this is about what I think it's worth, and it's a fully functioning solution, so may as well put it up for sale. But with Excited, I kind of lost the joy, because I started looking at it as my ticket out, you know.
I think that also illustrates a couple of things, though. I mean, one of the things is that when you're trying to package up an application as something that you're going to be giving or selling to other people, then there's the old saying about how it takes 90% of the time to get all the functionality in place and working, and then it takes the last 90% of the time to do all the other stuff you have to do to get it ready. That's one part of it, is that the finishing piece just can take forever. But the other thing is that after you spent a certain amount of time on something, then you just get to a point where you're like, gosh, you know, I feel like I've devoted my life to whatever this is for some amount of time. I'd better damn well get paid for it, right?
Right. And I did actually go through a brief period of mourning. Because when I set it aside, that was my idea. Nobody asked me to do that. I could have still sold it. It was obvious that I had written all of it before my current position, so it's my code. There's no conflict of interest in that. But there were certain considerations that I had to be honest with myself, that if I were to finish the job to where I would feel comfortable taking someone's money for it, you know, then I would need to put in that extra 90%. And I wanted to make sure it wouldn't be a conflict of interest, in the sense that I'd be spending so much time on that after hours that it would interfere with my real job. And that in all industries, not just software, but any entrepreneurial effort, I always hear that the toughest hurdle to get over is you have to get to a point where you're actually making more in your side venture than you do in your real job, because if you're going to be splitting off, then you got to account for things like health insurance and, you know, things that a lot of us can just take for granted if we've got a full-time day job. And so all of a sudden you have this transition where you're expending so much energy on the side that it starts eating into what you're currently committed to. And that's what I wanted to avoid, because the goal was no longer to escape. But eventually I did have to admit that I wasn't going to finish it. But at this point now, there's really no reason why I couldn't go back to it and just kind of chip away at it, because there's no urgency.
I mean, a couple of things, too, that I've learned is that kind of I think you all alluded to it earlier, that, you know, writing the code is one thing. You know, getting it into a form that's saleable is incredibly difficult. And Matt and I, when we first developed Idea Jam, it was kind of more a public site. And then all of a sudden, like Julian said, this is something that you're going to sell to some of the world's biggest companies. And they, you're not going to put crap out there. The documentation has to be first class. Your marketing material has to be first class. You have to answer the phone when they call for support. That's huge. And that's something that a lot of people, I'll just do email support. For big companies that spend a lot of money on your software, they're going to expect, they may not expect it, but if you don't deliver it, you may not have a customer in the future.
Yeah. Well, all of the applications that I've put out lately, EEE, the Excel export database, SOTU, Xcopy, they've never been a version 1 release. And I also put them out for free specifically because I know that I can't take calls for support. Sure, send me an email, shoot me an IM, say, hey, Chris, this sucks. I wanted to do X, Y, and Z. Hey, I'll work with you. The reason I'm open sourcing it is because it's a solution that I want to get out there to the community and have hopefully someone else benefit from what I've benefited. They all started off because I needed them to do something, as I think we've all been there. We get an idea for an application, not because, hey, do you know what I think will sell? It's this. It's because we're doing something and we really see a functional gap between the products that we use and the applications that we use and what we need to do for our day-to-day. I'm not going to be sitting there taking phone calls and supporting this stuff, so I put it out there. Sure, I put out a tip jar, and someone was actually nice enough to drop a small pittance in there, and I really appreciate it. I know that I don't have it in me to branch away and make that a full-time thing.
Julian, look at yourself, and then also look at Snaps, right? With all the quicker templates that they've developed, sometimes giving stuff away for free leads to other things. And I'm sure, Tim and Chris, some of the work that you've done, in the open source world, and SOTU and Xcopy and stuff like that, and OpenLog, Julian, in your case, and Stubby, that stuff leads to other things, right?
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah, I think that's at some point you have to decide if you do want to make money off your code. Well, I mean, the first decision is this something I even care to make money off of? Because there's a whole world of pain involved with getting yourself set up to really accept payments and do support and things like that, really proper licensing and contracts and maybe some international law and accountants and things like that. But if you do decide that, yes, this is something that should pay off for me in one way or another, then you're right. You have to decide, well, is it going to pay off? Am I going to try to make it pay off immediately by selling it? Or am I going to try to make this pay off as essentially advertising? Because like you said, it will open doors. It might get you a job. It may get you several jobs. It might establish expertise so you can do speaking gigs or open up conversations that you wouldn't have otherwise where people are sending you emails or something like that. So I've always tended to fall more on the advertising and services side of things, if anything, thinking that, well, I don't really plan on making money off the application directly. I think this should be some indirect income for me in terms of getting work or of making contacts or just sort of making myself known in the world.
Well, Tim was like a rock star at the Lotus Sphere product vendor showcase floor, whatever you want to call it.
He had high heels on, right, and a miniskirt?
A pink wig, if I remember correctly. Oh, wait. No, that was another party.
That was the night of the rave.
That was Chris Wissenant.
Well, Bruce, you – actually, Chris, am I interrupting? It seemed like you had a –
No, I'm just
like that was
I'm
the beginning
back
of a...
from the picturing you in a pink wig.
Absolutely.
Remember, we got to keep our NC-17.
Yes. Well, Bruce, you brought up.
I mean, we don't want an NC-17 rating. PG.
No.
No, G.
Yes. Keep it kid friendly, because we have more and more kids writing Lotus Script these days. But
oh, schnarf.
Yeah. Well, you brought up something earlier that I thought was interesting, the perception of value, and the something I've struggled against every time I've considered putting something up for sale or eventually went through with it is how do you actually assign a value to what you're selling? And there are a number of ways of going about that, right? One is you can do some sort of ROI analysis, right? Say, okay, well, how much time is this going to save my prospective customers? And then how much money does that translate into? Or if it's something that based on what the software does might actually generate additional revenue for the customers, then that would be a factor in the value equation. But at least for the kinds of things that I've put out there, it just feels so much more subjective than that. And so one of my struggles, and part of why, aside from JS Factor, I've never gone through with offering anything for sale, so that it always felt like any dollar amount that I would be assigning it would be completely arbitrary. And so how do I pick what the price should be?
Yeah. Well, Tim, not to interrupt, that you brought up an amazing point, because when we started selling Idea Jam and now Link Jam, you know, we priced it in the very beginning and people told us it was too cheap.
Yep.
So what we did is we came up with a pricing model, and some of the tricks you can do, because what happens is you have software support and maintenance, right? So that's going to keep you motivated in the future to develop, you know, new versions and keep your existing customers so they can pay you, you know, whatever, 15, 20% each year going forward so they can get updates. But what you have to do is, when I said 15 or 20%, that's based on your sale price, right? So if you're charging $50, you know, what's 20% of $50, right? So that's what you're going to get each year for continuing to write the code, which may not be a big motivator. Hence, your initial pricing should be, you know, how would you say? You got to find it, like, it's hard. You got to find that magical price point. Some people are going to say, oh, Tim, that's too expensive. Or they're going to say, that's price right. And some of them are going to say, hey, heck, that's cheap. I'll take 20 copies, you know?
Right. And when I was originally thinking of selling Excited, I was trying to decide, well, you know, what's a fair amount, right? And so originally I was thinking something in the $50 range, because and maybe this is purely a self-esteem issue, but I was thinking, well, I was proud of what it was turning into, but I guess I had this hurdle of I don't think I'm cool enough to sell something for several hundred dollars, right? But then when I started bouncing that price point off a few people, they gave me the same feedback that you got. If you sell it for $50, people will think it's $50 software, so they won't buy it because they'll perceive it to be to perceive its value to be less than what it actually is. And so I thought, well, okay, how can I bump up that price without feeling like I'm robbing my customers, and still at the same time, actually, you know, keep it low enough to where people actually would still buy it while perceiving it to be of value. And so I finally came up with the $200 purchase price. And the reason that I settled on that was because shortly before I started writing Excited, I was in a position where I really, really needed Chow.
Chow is and, Team Studio Chow, not food to keep you alive.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And the
Tim, that's hungry.
Right. That's where Design Catalog came from, was that I really needed Chow. My employer at the time said they couldn't justify the expense. And so I'm like, well, fine, I'll write as close to a substitute for it as I can. And but looking back on that, when I was trying to come up with a price point for Excited, I thought, well, because I think the licenses were around $800 or $900 just for the Chow component at the time for one license. And I thought, well, I really want this tool, but my boss won't buy it for me. And I can't justify spending $800-$900 of my own money just because it's going to make my job easier. It's the same reason I use GIMP instead of Photoshop. So I thought, well, what have I bought out of my own pocket because I knew it would make my job easier or more fun or more fulfilling or whatever? And the most I could remember ever having spent for something of that nature was right around $200. So that is plain and simple the reason that I chose that price. That never went through with actually selling it, but that's why I chose the price, was realizing that that's high enough where a company that can justify that expense for that type of software is going to see it as not just some guy on a couch writing code, even though I was some guy on a couch writing code.
They will now.
But it would still be low enough that there would be a few developers out there that would ask their boss to buy it and be told that, well, no, we don't have any dollars for that in the budget. And so a few of those would still say, well, I want this anyway, I'll just buy it.
See, my story, and I run a company that sells a CRM solution as one of its products. And I had set the price point mainly because I had known a certain unethical used car salesman-like salesperson that would never tell the person what the price was until he could figure out how much he could get out of them. Literally setting the price point on, hey, well, what's in your wallet? So, okay. Now, factor in the total disgust. Yeah, Bruce, you're right. Factor in the total disgust with that type of salesperson, with the fact that I grew up as a fat kid, and I couldn't set the price higher than I knew what the competitors were charging. So, and I also wanted to be totally upfront and honest. So I had set up a CRM solution that, quite frankly, as far as functionality concerned, was competitive with the big boys, easily $200 less per seat than what anyone else charged. And the price point was $250 per user with a 20% maintenance and support yearly or annual charge. Now, I set that price again because I wanted to keep my solution above that $50, you know, shrink wrap shelfware. This really isn't going to meet my needs. But I also I want to hit that, not to hit that sweet spot because I'm all that smart and thought that the 250 price range would actually do the job, but
I just couldn't bring myself to bump up that price to the $450, $500, sometimes $600 per seat, or like the unnamed salesperson would say, hey, what's in your wallet?
Yeah, but you know, I'm going to go off on a ledge here. Most of the – like we're talking about Notes and Domino stuff here for the most part, right? And these are big companies you're dealing with, and for, you know, $400 a seat, you know, that's nothing, guys. And my suggestion is aim high, man. Don't rip people off. You know, give them that perceived value, but don't be afraid to price the application. You know, you're a human, man. You got to live. And your intellectual property doesn't go out for free.
I admitted earlier that I suck as a salesperson, and this is namely why. Because I personally can't bring myself, and I haven't been successful in saying this is what I deserve. And maybe it was growing up as a fat kid. Maybe it was, you know, going through that really horrible, you know, time spent with that really just nasty salesperson who was just would sell his own mother up the river if he thought it would give him, you know, a few extra points that quarter. I just.
You know what Chris, I'm going to interrupt again. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But you know what it is?
No,
there aren't many places. You know, the web is a great thing, right? We live and work in a small community, right? The Notes and Domino world. Yeah, we have great, great community efforts. We have OpenNTF. We have Planet Lotus. We have the Yellowcast and the Taking Notes podcast and all this other kind of stuff. But we don't have any more things like Advisor Magazine, Group Computing, Libby's new
ePro.
ePro and things like that, where you used to be able to buy, you know, ad space and stuff. And the distribution of those magazines was way more than, you know, people, daily visitors to, you know, your blog, my blog, Planet Lotus and stuff like that. We just don't have those things anymore. And again, you know, yeah, we have the blogosphere and stuff like that, but that is such a small world. We don't have – I guess IBM does have like a, you know, a product catalog, but it sucks. You know, the best product catalog out there right now is the stuff Alan Lepofsky has on his website. I've looked at some of his Google analytics. He doesn't know it, but they're incredible. Thousands and thousands of people each day hitting those pages, and that's something. We don't have like an application catalog that's well done for the community. You know, IBM has one. Not for the community. I mean for businesses.
Well, I think we also don't have an unbiased catalog. Now, Alan's is very unbiased. He put everything out there. He even included my stuff, which I was honored. And I do see at least, I'd say, a good 25 to 30 referrals from his site maybe every other day. Mm-hmm. And but we don't have anything that Joe user is going to be able to go to and say, hey, I need this, at least that I know of,
you know what,
and get truly unbiased. Like I need a solution that will allow my organization to share ideas, collaborate on those ideas, and graduate the best of the best. IdeaJam should be included in that list. I don't know if it is today or not, and what you have to do and what hoops you have to jump through in order to get them there. And this is why, maybe because I've never played that part of the game, or I'm just not good at it in playing that part of the game, that I don't know how to even – I don't know how to make it to the field, let alone play the game.
Yeah.
That's where I'm sort of going.
You know what? Salesforce.com has something, and this is something that, you know, they have a developer community, if not, you know, the same size as the Lotus developer community or much or bigger, but they have something called the App Exchange, and you as a developer of a Salesforce, you know, Force.com platform application can package your app up, stick it out on the App Exchange, create a test drive version of it, create the downloadable, purchasable version of it, and all you need to do, and you can be a user, you could be an administrator, you have a pull down, you know, in your GUI that says App Exchange, and it tells you what it is, and you click there, And there is a wealth right in your face. All the different, you know, categories of applications right there for you to play with, download, purchase, anything. You look at the Notes client, right? And the Notes client has no linkages to anything outside of IBM's help and stuff like that.
Well, Bruce, I think you're brushing up against one delicious bit of irony. And that is, by offering some of these things for sale, you actually have a chance of putting it into more hands than if you're giving it away for free. And I know that sounds completely backwards, but you probably know exactly what I mean by that. Because the OpenNTF mail experience is one of the primary exceptions I can point to. And OpenLog is another one of them. I've lost count of how many clients I've interacted with in the last year that are either using the OpenNTF mail experience as their company's primary mail template, or they're using OpenLog as their standard logging approach in all of their applications, or both. But those are the two main exceptions. Most of the time, when a client or just somebody who hits me up on BleedYellowIM, et cetera, asks me, do you know of any product that does this or does that? If I respond with, well, hey, check out this OpenNTF project. It does exactly what you're looking for. More often than not, the response is, well, that's just a shareware, or that's a free open source thing. And so, again, that perception of value, a lot of corporations assume that if something is free, it has no value. And with OpenNTF, despite all of the wonderful, fully fleshed out, proven solutions that are out there that people could just grab and use now, open source has this, and it's getting better, but there's still this stigma attached to it that the source being open somehow makes the software less secure, or the solution being free means it's worth less. So not even in the Notes and Domino world, I was on one contract where everything they did was web-based, and they were using rich text editors on their web pages, and they had paid top dollar for some plugin that would create rich text editors for the web. And there were so many limitations to it. It was ActiveX based, so it only supported IE. Now I know you can use ActiveX in other browsers, but the way that they had implemented it was it only supported IE. Now, in many corporate contexts, that's fine because the corporation says, well, we only support IE anyway. But the point was they were paying top dollar for this solution that was kludgy and it was really buggy. And so I said, well, why not use FCK editor? And the response was, A, it's open source, so we don't trust it. B, it's free, so we don't think it's worth anything. And C, just look at the name. And I said, okay, Ner, FCK is the guy's initials, the guy that wrote it. He probably should have called it something else, I'll grant you that. But evaluate it at least so that you can see how much more full-featured it is than what you're paying for now, how much less buggy it is, and it's free. But 6 months later, they were still completely discarding that notion. So I guess that's one of the experiences that sort of colors my perspective on all of this, is that I'm a big proponent of open source. But I also see all the time where actually putting something out there for sale has an opportunity to put the software in more people's hands, because in these larger corporate environments, they're more likely to trust it if they have to write a check.
Well, has anyone ever seen the TurboTax commercial where the – I think it's TurboTax online. I could be wrong. Correct me if I am. But the wife is telling the husband, oh, I don't know. Let's ask the box, because now that she's – they're being audited.
Yeah, I remember that.
That is the perception with open source solutions 9 times out of 10 that, well, what am I going to contact the website when I have a problem? Like, who's going to help me? If I pay $600 per seat, I'm going to get a live person on the other end of the line that I can scream at when I've been using my CD-ROM tray as a coffee cup holder.
Yeah, and you know, for someone who was the ombudsman for OpenNTF for such a long time, that's kind of the question I usually got, you know, from people. I really like this XYZ application, but the project chef never responds to my request. There's no updates. And frankly, I think Julian – no, I'm kidding.
no. I was going to say, are you talking about OpenWAM?
No. But that's a huge issue, and I know we're going long on time here. But these are all things – I really encourage people to write code, put it out there. And figure out ways to work with business partners, you know, bloggers, any way you can to help get the word out about some code you've written, some documentation you've provided with it, the support you give it, you know, do it. I mean, there's, you know, by the time tomorrow comes, it'll be today and too late. So
if I could make one small suggestion, we've all done this. You use something that you've written for yourself, especially if you're a developer. You're doing something that you might think is only specific to your needs. I guarantee someone else out there can use it. So just package it up, put it out there, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks. You're going to get people. Tim uses Xcopy now all the time. He uses it as a round trip backup to his – what, to your SAN?
My NAS. I don't have your a SAN NAS. Yet.
But if you – if I didn't put that out there, you would just be using a third-party solution that quite frankly you couldn't rip the source open and start playing around and schedule it to be whenever you want and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things that you might overlook and say, oh, well, you know, it's a smart icon. I don't really see that much of a big deal. Or, oh, it's just this local agent that I run that does, you know, this and this and this and this. Put it out there, because 9 times out of 10, you're going to find someone that has that need.
Just look at the guy who wrote the I Am Rich iPhone application for $999. It 8 people bought it. You guys familiar with that?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could be you, Bruce.
Yeah, I Am Rich.
I don't follow news on the toy world. What was it?
Oh boy!
that's going to start a flame war. But right. just to keep things in perspective, that Xcopy tool, you're exactly right. Up until you put that out there, I was using a third party solution to do exactly what you wrote does, and it was a Microsoft piece of software. Now, granted, Xcopy is technically Microsoft because it's a Windows utility. But I was using a Windows utility for running Xcopy. So, yeah. Anyway.
Wait, so now instead of a third-party application, it's a second-party application?
Well, instead of using a Microsoft GUI utility to run a Microsoft command line, now I've at least got one layer that's Domino. So I feel a little bit less creepy about that.
You only set it up because you felt bad because you were the second download, including me testing it for the first.
So you guys do a podcast, right?
Upon occasion.
Yeah, so you guys have 5 episodes, right, of the Yellow Cast, right?
Yeah.
What's this Yellow stuff about?
Well, Chris and I talk all the time, and we at some point decided, well, we find each other entertaining and occasionally informative. Maybe other people would too. Kind of the Xcopy
G rating,
right? Well, we noticed that both of us tend to let loose a little bit, and so just to be on the safe side, we marked the podcast as explicit. Now, I think to some extent, and Chris, maybe I'm only speaking for myself, but I think we've used that disclaimer to grant ourselves a little unnecessary license. So we might.
Especially the last episode where was perfectly fine and Tim just jumped in both feet with, wow, yeah.
It was awkward, okay? It was an awkward situation.
Well, you know, the music doesn't help either.
That's true.
I love the music.
Well,
poor Tim has to deal with my selection every week or every time we do the cast. And if you've never met Tim, he's the nicest guy in the world. And if you were stepping on his foot, he wouldn't say ow. So when I send him over the music selection, I'm like, so what do you think of this? And in his mind, he's probably like, oh, there goes any credibility I've ever had in associating with this baboon.
Yeah, like where what was the name of the Lego Star Wars rap song?
Oh, that was Fett's Vet.
Yeah.
That was from MC Chris. That's a classic.
That was a great one, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a mashup, Woo Colors with Ice-T and the Ya-Ya's, I want to say. There was Beastie Boys mashup with Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack.
Oh yeah. Now do you guys actually publish the names of the songs you play? Because you really should if you don't.
I don't want to get sued. a lot of them are mashups.
Elm Street.
Yes. See, people are gonna start downloading the episodes now, just listen to the intro and then skip back to their playlist.
Yeah. I think as long as there's a link to buy it on iTunes, you're safe.
That's probably true.
I have Zune. I mean, you know, all this Mac talk is making my brain ache.
Zune? Yeah.
Yes.
We don't play with toys.
Right.
Zinga! Zinga!
All right. Hey, I think we've probably gone pretty long, especially now that we're talking about music, man.
You know,
so, Bruce, let's wrap it up.
FCK, Fat Coder Kid, is that what that is? FCK editor?
Sure.
What's wrong with fat coders, Bruce?
They just want to.
What the HE double hockey sticks, man?
Jeez. Well, guys, we should do this more often. And maybe not talk about boring things like coding, but talking about like things to do at Lotusphere or something like that, or basket weaving, or something. No, okay,
Sounds good.
Okay, wasn't fun.
This has been fun.
It's been a blast.
All right.
Next time you guys can call us.
Exactly. So that's 86 in the can. I guess we're going to 86 it out of here right now, right? And I guess I got to do some work putting this thing together and add in like dueling banjos and a couple other maybe beeps in honor of you guys. So,
yeah, some unnecessary censorship is in order, I think. Chris, if you haven't ever sent Bruce the link to that Dora the Explorer clip, yeah, Bruce needs to see that.
Yeah, if you want some suggestions for some intros, I got them coming over.
Remember, we got to keep the G rating here. All right, we're going to wrap it up. 86 in the can. Thanks, Chris Toohey, and thanks, Tim Tripconey or Tripkiny, depending on whether you're British or not. And Mr. Robichaux, 86 in the can, and we'll talk to you soon for 87. And we don't know what 87 is going to be about yet, but I'm sure it'll be just dandy.
Yeah, we'll figure something out.
And for those of you who have not signed up for Collaboration University yet, Julian?
Oh, we didn't even talk about Collaboration University. You still have time. The Chicago event is September 8th through the 10th, and the London event is September 15th through 17th. And we'll go ahead and put a link for you in the show notes if you want some information and find out all about Collab U, which is, I think this is going to be like the 6th and the 7th or the 7th and the 8th or something like that, rendition of Collaboration University, so they've kind of got it down by now.
All right, it's time for some beers. Talk to you soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Later.